the hospital staff could contact the researchers who were conducting the trial. 4 hours later, after the results of the lab test came back totally normal, a physician who had been part of the clinical drug trial arrived. Checking the code on the label of Mason's empty pill bottle, the researcher looked into the records for the trial. He announced that Mason had actually been taking a placebo, and that the pills he had swallowed contained no drugs at all. Miraculously, Mason's blood pressure and pulse returned to normal within a few minutes. And as if by magic, he was no longer excessively drowsy either. Mason had fallen victim to the nocebo, a harmless substance that, thanks to strong expectations, causes harmful effects. Is it really possible that Mason's symptoms had been brought on solely because that's what he'd expected to happen from swallowing a huge handful of antidepressants? Could Mason's mind, as in the case of Sam Londe, have taken control of his body, driven by expectations of what seemed to be the most probable future scenario, to the extent that he made that scenario real? Could that happen, even if that meant his mind would have to take control of functions not normally under conscious control? And if that were possible, could it also be true that if our thoughts can make us sick, we also have the ability to use our thoughts to make us well? Janice Schoenfeld, a 46-year-old interior designer living in California, had suffered with depression since she was a teenager. She had never sought help with the condition until she saw a newspaper ad in 1997. The UCLA Neuropsychiatric Institute was looking for volunteer subjects for a drug trial to test a new antidepressant called venlafaxine, Effexor. Schoenfeld, whose depression had escalated to the point where the wife and mother had actually entertained thoughts of suicide, jumped at the chance to be part of the trial. When Schoenfeld arrived at the institute for the first time, a technician hooked her up to an electroencephalograph, EEG, to monitor and record her brainwave activity for about 45 minutes. And not long after that, Schoenfeld left with a bottle of pills from the hospital pharmacy. She knew that roughly half the group of 51 subjects would be getting the drug, and half would receive a placebo, although neither she nor the doctors conducting the study had any idea which group she had been randomly assigned to. In fact, no one would know until the study was over. But at the time, that hardly mattered to Schoenfeld. She was excited and hopeful that after decades of battling clinical depression, a condition that would cause her to sometimes suddenly burst into tears for no apparent reason, she might finally be getting help. Schoenfeld agreed to return every week for the entire 8 weeks of the study. On each occasion, she had answered questions about how she was feeling, and several times she sat through yet another EEG. Not long after she started taking her pills, Schoenfeld began feeling dramatically better for the first time in her life. Ironically, she also felt nauseated, but that was good news because she knew that nausea was one of the common side effects of the drug being tested. She thought that she surely must have gotten the active drug if her depression was lifting and she was also experiencing side effects. Even the nurse she spoke to when she returned every week was convinced Schoenfeld must be getting the real thing because of the changes she was experiencing. Finally, at the end of the 8-week study, one of the researchers revealed the shocking truth. Schoenfeld, who was no longer suicidal and felt like a new person after taking the pills, had actually been in the placebo group. Schoenfeld was floored. She was sure the doctor had made a mistake. She simply didn't believe that she could have felt so much better after so many years of suffocating depression simply from taking a bottle of sugar pills. and she'd even gotten the side effects. There must have been a mix-up. She asked the doctor to check the records again. He laughed good-naturedly as he assured her that the bottle she had taken home with her, the bottle that had given Schoenfeld her life back, indeed contained nothing but placebo pills. As she sat there in shock, the doctor insisted that just because she hadn't been getting any real medication, it didn't mean that she had been imagining her depression or her improvement. It only meant that whatever had made her feel better wasn't due to Effexor. And she wasn't the only one. The study results would soon show that 38% of the placebo group felt better, compared to 52% of the group who received Effexor. But when the rest of the data came out, it was the researchers' turn to be surprised. The patients like Schoenfeld, who had improved on the placebos, hadn't just imagined feeling better, they had actually changed their brainwave patterns. The EEG recordings taken so faithfully over the course of the study showed a significant increase in activity in the prefrontal cortex, which in depressed patients typically has very low activity. Thus, the placebo effect was not only altering Schoenfeld's mind, but also bringing about real physical changes in her biology. In other words, it wasn't just in her mind, it was in her brain. She wasn't just feeling well, she was well. Schoenfeld literally had a different brain by the end of the study, without taking any drug or doing anything differently. It was her mind that had changed her body. More than a dozen years later, Schoenfeld still felt much improved. How is it possible that a sugar pill could not only lift the symptoms of deep-seated depression, but also cause bona fide side effects like nausea? And what does it mean that the same inert substance actually has the power to change how brainwaves fire, increasing activity in the very part of the brain most affected by depression? Can the subjective mind really create those kinds of measurable, objective, physiological changes? What's going on in the mind and in the body that would allow a placebo to so perfectly mimic a real drug in this way? Could the same phenomenal healing effect occur not only with chronic mental illness, but also with a life-threatening condition such as cancer? In 1957, UCLA psychologist Bruno Klopfer published an article in a peer-reviewed journal telling the story of a man he referred to as Mr. Wright, who had advanced lymphoma, a cancer of the lymph glands. The man had huge tumors, some as big as an orange, in his neck, groin, and armpits, and his cancer was not responding to all the conventional treatments. He lay in his bed for weeks, febrile, grasping for air, completely bedridden. His doctor, Philip West, had given up hope, although Wright himself had not. When Wright found out that the hospital where he was being treated, in Long Beach, California, just happened to be one of 10 hospitals and research centers in the country that were evaluating an experimental drug extracted from horse blood called probiazin, he got very excited. Wright unrelentingly badgered Dr. West for days until the physician agreed to give him some of the new remedy, even though Wright couldn't officially be part of the trial, which required patients to have at least a 3-month life expectancy. Wright received his injection of crobiazin on a Friday, and by Monday, he was walking around, laughing and joking with his nurses, acting pretty much like a new man. Dr. West reported that the tumors had melted like snowballs on a hot stove. Within 3 days, the tumors were half their original size. In 10 more days, Wright was sent home. He had been cured. It seemed like a miracle. But 2 months later, the media reported that the 10 trials showed that crobiazin turned out to be a dud. once Wright read the news, became fully conscious of the results, and embraced the thought that the drug was useless, he relapsed immediately, with his tumors soon returning. Dr. West suspected that Wright's initial positive response was due to the placebo effect, and knowing that his patient was terminal, he figured he had little to lose, and Wright had everything to gain, by testing out his theory. So the doctor told Wright not to believe the newspaper reports, and that he'd suffered a relapse because the crebiacin they'd given Wright was found to be part of a bad batch. What Dr. West called a new, super-refined, double-strength version of the drug was on its way to the hospital, and Wright could have it as soon as it arrived. In anticipation of being cured, Wright was elated, and a few days later he received the injection. But this time, the syringe Dr. West used contained no drug, experimental or not. The syringe was filled only with distilled water. Again, Wright's tumors magically vanished. He happily returned home and did well for another 2 months, free of tumors in his body. But then the American Medical Association made the announcement that crebiacin was indeed worthless. The medical establishment had been duped. The miracle drug turned out to be a hoax, nothing more than mineral oil containing a simple amino acid. The manufacturers were eventually indicted. Upon hearing the news, Wright relapsed a final time, no longer believing in the possibility of health. He returned to the hospital hopeless, and 2 days later was dead. Is it possible that Wright somehow changed his state of being, not once, but twice, to that of a man who simply didn't have cancer, in a matter of days? Did his body then automatically respond to a new mind? And could he have changed his state back to that of a man with cancer once he heard the drug was purported to be worthless, with his body creating exactly the same chemistry and returning to the familiar, sickened condition? Is it possible to achieve such a new biochemical state, not only when taking a pill or getting a shot, but also when undergoing something as invasive as surgery? In 1996, orthopedic surgeon Bruce Mosley, then of the Baylor College of Medicine, and one of Houston's leading experts in orthopedic sports medicine, published a trial study based on his experience with 10 volunteers, all men who had served in the military and suffered from osteoarthritis of the knee. Due to the severity of their conditions, many of these men had a noticeable limp, walked with a cane, or needed some type of assistance to get around. The study was designed to look at arthroscopic surgery, a popular surgery that involved anesthetizing the patient before making a small incision to insert a fiber optic instrument called an arthroscope, which the surgeon would use to get a good look at the patient's joint. In the surgery, the doctor would then scrape and rinse the joint to remove any fragments of degenerated cartilage that were thought to be the cause of the inflammation and pain. At that time, about 750,000 patients received this surgery every year. In Dr. Mosley's study, 2 of the 10 men were to be given the standard surgery, called a debridement, where the surgeon scrapes strands of cartilage from the knee joint. 3 of them were to receive a procedure called a lavage, where high-pressured water is injected through the knee joint, rinsing and flushing out the decayed arthritic material. And 5 of them would receive sham surgery, in which Dr. Mosley would deftly slice through their skin with a scalpel and then just sew them back up again without performing any medical procedure at all. For those 5 men, there would be no arthroscope, no scraping of the joint, no removal of bone fragments, and no washing. Just an incision and then stitches. The start of each of the 10 procedures was exactly the same. The patient was wheeled into the operating room and given general anesthesia, while Dr. Mosley scrubbed up. Once the surgeon entered the operating theater, he would find a sealed envelope waiting for him that would tell him which of the three groups the patient on the table had been randomly assigned to. Dr. Moseley would have no idea what the envelope contained until he actually ripped it open. After the surgery, all 10 of the patients in the study reported greater mobility and less pain. In fact, the men who received pretend surgery did just as well as those who'd received debridement or lavage surgery. There was no difference in the results, even 6 months later. And 6 years later, when two of the men who'd received the placebo surgery were interviewed, they reported that they were still walking normally without pain and had greater range of motion. They said that they could now perform all the everyday activities that they hadn't been able to do before the surgery 6 years earlier. The men felt as though they'd regained their lives. Fascinated by the results, Dr. Moseley published another study in 2002 involving 180 patients who were followed for 2 years after their surgeries. Again, all three groups improved, with patients beginning to walk without pain or limping immediately after the surgery. But again, neither of the two groups who actually had the surgery improved any more than the patients who'd received the placebo surgery. And this held true even after 2 years. Could it be possible that these patients got better simply because they had faith and belief in the healing power of the surgeon, the hospital, and even in the gleaming, modern operating room itself? Did they somehow envision a life with a fully healed knee, simply surrender to that possible outcome, and then literally walk right into it? Was Dr. Moseley, in effect, nothing more than a modern-day witch doctor in a white lab coat? And is it possible to attain the same degree of healing when facing something more threatening, maybe something as serious as heart surgery? In the late 1950s, two groups of researchers conducted studies comparing the then-standard surgery for angina to a placebo. This was well before the coronary artery bypass graft, the surgery most often used today. Back then, most heart patients received a procedure known as internal mammary ligation, which involved exposing the damaged arteries and intentionally tying them off. The thinking was that if surgeons blocked the blood flow in this way, it would force the body to sprout new vascular channels, increasing blood flow to the heart. The surgery was extremely successful for the huge majority of patients who had it, although doctors had no solid proof that any new blood vessels were ever actually created, hence the motivation for the two studies. These groups of researchers, one in Kansas City and one in Seattle, each followed the same procedure, dividing their study subjects into two groups. One received the standard internal mammary ligation, and the other received a sham surgery. The surgeons made the same small incisions into the patient's chests that they made for the real surgery, exposing the arteries, but then they just sewed the patients back up, doing nothing more. The results of both studies were strikingly similar. 67% of the patients who had received the actual surgery felt less pain and needed less medication, while 83% of those who had received the sham surgery enjoyed the same level of improvement. The placebo surgery had actually worked better than the real surgery. Could it be that somehow the patients who had received the sham surgery so believed that they'd get better that they actually did get better, through nothing more than holding that expectation for the best? And if that is possible, what does that say about the effects our everyday thoughts, whether positive or negative, have on our bodies and our health? A wealth of research now exists to show that our attitude does indeed affect our health, including how long we live. For example, the Mayo Clinic published a study in 2002 that followed 447 people for more than 30 years, showing that optimists were healthier physically and mentally. Optimist literally means best, suggesting that those folks focus their attention on the best future scenario. Specifically, the optimists had fewer problems with daily activities as a result of their physical health or their emotional state, experienced less pain, felt more energetic, had an easier time with social activities, and felt happier, calmer, and more peaceful most of the time. This came right on the heels of another Mayo Clinic study that followed more than 800 people for 30 years, showing that optimists live longer than pessimists. Researchers at Yale followed 660 people, aged 50 and older, for up to 23 years, discovering that those with a positive attitude about aging live more than 7 years longer than those who had a more negative outlook about growing older. Attitude had more of an influence on longevity than blood pressure, cholesterol levels, smoking, body weight, or level of exercise. Additional studies have looked more specifically at heart health and attitude. Around the same time, a Duke University study of 866 heart patients reported that those who routinely felt more positive emotions had a 20% greater chance of being alive 11 years later than those who habitually experienced more negative emotions. Even more striking are the results of a study of 255 medical students at the Medical College of Georgia who were followed for 25 years. Those who were the most hostile had 5 times greater incident of coronary heart disease. And a John Hopkins study presented at the American Heart Association's 2001 scientific sessions even showed that a positive outlook may offer the strongest known protection against heart disease in adults at risk due to family history. This study suggests that having the right attitude can work as well or better than eating the proper diet, getting the right amount of exercise, and maintaining the ideal body weight. How is it that our everyday mindset, whether we're generally more joyful and loving, or more hostile and negative, can help determine how long we live? Is it possible for us to change our current mindset? If so, could having a new mindset override the way our minds have been conditioned by past experiences? Or could expecting something negative to recur actually help to bring that about? According to the National Cancer Institute, a condition called anticipatory nausea occurs in about 29% of patients receiving chemotherapy when they are exposed to the smells and sights that remind them of their chemo treatments. About 11% feel so sick before their treatments that they actually vomit. Some cancer patients start feeling nauseated in the car on the way to get chemo before they even set foot inside the hospital, while others throw up while still in the waiting room. A 2001 study from the University of Rochester Cancer Center, published in the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management, concluded that expecting nausea was the strongest predictor that patients would actually experience it. The researchers' data reported that 40% of chemo patients who thought they would get sick because their doctors told them that they probably would be sick after the treatment went on to develop nausea before the treatment was even administered. An additional 13% who said they were unsure of what to expect also got sick. Yet none of the patients who didn't expect to get nauseated got sick. How can it be that some people become so convinced that they will get sick from chemotherapy drugs that they get ill before any of the drugs are even administered? Is it possible that the power of their thoughts could be what's making them sick? And if that's true of 40% of chemo patients, could it also be true that 40% of folks could just as easily get well by simply changing their thoughts about what to expect about their health or from their day? Could a single thought that a person accepts also make that person better? Not long ago, as I was about to get off an aeroplane in Austin, I met a woman who was reading a book that caught my eye. We were standing and waiting to deplane, and I saw the book sticking out of her bag. The title mentioned the word belief. We smiled at each other, and I asked her what the book was about. "Christianity and faith," she answered. "Why do you ask?" I told her that I was writing a new book on the placebo effect and that my book was all about belief. "I want to tell you this story," she said. She went on to tell me that years ago she had been diagnosed with gluten intolerance, celiac disease, colitis, and a host of other ills, and experienced chronic pain. She had read up on the diseases and gone to see several different health professionals for advice. They had advised her to avoid certain foods and to take certain prescription drugs, which she had done, but she had still felt pain throughout her entire body. She also hadn't been able to sleep, had skin rashes and severe digestive disturbances, and suffered from a whole list of other unpleasant symptoms. Then, years later, the woman went to see a new doctor who decided to do some blood tests. When the blood test came back, all of the results were negative. The day I found out I was really normal and there was nothing wrong with me, I thought, "I'm fine," and all my symptoms went away. "I immediately felt great and could eat whatever I wanted," she told me with a flourish. Smiling, she added, "What do you believe about that?" If it's true that learning new information that leads to a 180-degree turnaround in what we believe about ourselves can actually make our symptoms disappear, what's going on in our bodies that's supporting that and making it happen? What's the exact relationship between the mind and the body? Could it be possible that those new beliefs could actually change our brains and body chemistries, physically rewire our neurological circuitry of who we think we are, and alter our genetic expression? Could we in fact become different people? Parkinson's disease is a neurological disorder marked by the gradual degeneration of nerve cells in the portion of the midbrain called the basal ganglia, which controls body movements. The brains of those who have this heartbreaking disease don't produce enough of the neurotransmitter dopamine, which the basal ganglia needs for proper functioning. Early symptoms of Parkinson's, which is currently considered incurable, include motor issues such as muscle rigidity, tremors, and changes in gait and speech patterns that override voluntary control. In one study, a group of researchers at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver informed a group of Parkinson's patients that they were going to receive a drug that would significantly improve their symptoms. In reality, the patients received a placebo, nothing more than a saline injection. Even so, half of them who had no drug intervention, in fact, had much better motor control after receiving the injection. The researchers then scanned the patients' brains to get a better idea of what had happened, and found that the people who responded positively to the placebo were actually manufacturing dopamine in their brains, as much as 200% more than before. To get an equivalent effect with a drug, you'd have to administer roughly a full dose of amphetamine, a mood-elevating drug that also increases dopamine. It seemed that merely expecting to get better unleashed some previously untapped power within the Parkinson's patients that triggered the production of the dopamine, exactly what their bodies needed to get better. And if this is true, then what is the process by which thought alone can manufacture dopamine in the brain? Might such a new internal state, brought on by the combination of clear intention and heightened emotional state, actually make us invincible in certain situations by activating our own inner storehouse of pharmaceuticals and overriding the genetic circumstances of disease that we once considered outside of our conscious control? In parts of Appalachia exist pockets of a 100-year-old religious ritual known as snake handling, or taking up serpents. While West Virginia is the only state where it's still legal, that doesn't stop the faithful, and local police in other states are known to turn a blind eye to the practice. In these small and modest churches, as congregations gather for the worship service, the preacher enters carrying one or more briefcase-shaped locked wooden boxes with hinged, clear plastic doors perforated with air holes, and places the boxes carefully on the platform at the front of the sanctuary or meeting room near the pulpit. Before long, the music starts, a high-energy blend of country and western and bluegrass melodies with deeply religious lyrics about salvation and the love of Jesus. Live musicians wail away on keyboards, electric guitars, and even drum sets that any teenage band would envy, while the parishioners shake tambourines as the spirit moves them. As the energy builds, the preacher might light a flame in a container on top of the pulpit and hold his hand in the fire, allowing the flames to lick his outstretched palm before he picks up the container to sweep the fire slowly over his bare forearms. He's just getting warmed up. The congregants soon begin swaying and laying hands on one another, speaking in tongues and jumping up and down, dancing to the music in praise of their Savior. They are overcome with the Spirit, what they call being anointed. Then it's time for the preacher to flip open one of the locked boxes, reach a hand in, and pull out a deadly snake, usually a rattlesnake, cottonmouth, or copperhead. He too is dancing and working up quite a sweat as he holds the live serpent around its middle so that the snake's head is frighteningly close to the preacher's own head and throat. He might hold the snake high in the air before bringing it back down closer to his body, dancing all the while as the snake winds its lower half around his arm and gyrates its upper half in the air in whatever manner it pleases. The preacher might then get a second or even a third snake from additional wooden cases, and the congregants, men and women alike, might join him in handling the serpents as they feel the anointing coming over them. In some services, the preacher might even ingest a poison like strychnine from a simple drinking glass without suffering any ill effects. Although the snake handlers do sometimes get bitten, considering the thousands of services where feverish believers have reached into those hinged wooden boxes without a trace of doubt or fear, it doesn't happen often. And even when it does, they don't always die, even though they don't rush to the hospital, preferring instead to have the congregation gather around them in prayer. Why are these people not bitten more often? And why aren't there more deaths when they do get bitten? How can they get into a state of mind where they are not afraid of such venomous creatures whose bite is known to be deadly? And how can that state of mind protect them? Then there are displays of extreme strength in emergency situations, known as hysterical strength. In April 2013, for example, 16-year-old Hannah Smith and her 14-year-old sister Haley of Lebanon, Oregon, lifted a 3,000-pound tractor to free their father, Jeff Smith, who was trapped underneath. And what about firewalkers? Indigenous tribes practicing sacred rituals and Westerners taking workshops who stroll across burning coals. Or even the carnival showmen or Javanese trance dancers who feel compelled to chew and swallow glass, a disorder known as hyalophagia. How are such seemingly superhuman feats possible? And do they have something vital in common? Could it be that at the height of their uncompromising belief, these people are somehow changing their bodies such that they become immune to their environments? And can the same rock-solid belief that empowers snake handlers and firewalkers also go the other way, causing us to harm ourselves and even die without our having any awareness of what we're doing? In 1938, a 60-year-old man in rural Tennessee spent 4 months getting sicker and sicker before his wife brought him to a 15-bed hospital at the edge of town. By this time, Vance Vanders, not his real name, had lost more than 50 pounds and appeared to be near death. The doctor, Drayton Doherty, suspected that Vanders was suffering from tuberculosis, or possibly cancer, but repeated tests and x-rays came up negative. Dr. Doherty's physical examination showed nothing that could be causing Vanders distress. Vanders refused to eat, so he was given a feeding tube, but he stubbornly vomited whatever was put down the tube. He continued to get worse, repeating the conviction that he was going to die, and eventually he was barely able to talk. The end seemed near, although Dr. Doherty still had no idea what the man's affliction was. Vander's distraught wife asked to speak to Dr. Doherty privately, and swearing him to secrecy, told him that her husband's problem was that he'd been voodooed. It seemed that Vanders, who lived in a community where voodoo was a common practice, had had an argument with a local voodoo priest. The priest had summoned Vanders to the cemetery late one night, where he put a hex on the man by waving a bottle of malodorous liquid in front of Vanders' face. The priest told Vanders that he would soon die and that no one could save him. That was it. Vanders was convinced that his days were numbered and thus believed in a new, dismal future reality. The defeated man returned home and refused to eat. Eventually, his wife brought him to the hospital. After Dr. Doherty had heard the whole story, he came up with a rather unorthodox plan for treating his patient. In the morning, he summoned Vander's family to his bedside and told them that he was now certain that he knew how to cure the sick man. The family listened intently as Dr. Doherty spun the following fabricated tale. He said that on the previous night, he had gone to the cemetery where he'd tricked the voodoo priest into meeting with him and divulging how he had voodooed Vanders. It hadn't been easy, Dr. Doherty said. The priest had understandably not wanted to cooperate, although he finally relented once Dr. Doherty had pinned him against a tree and choked him. Dr. Doherty said that the priest had told him that he had rubbed some lizard eggs into Vanders' skin, and that the eggs had found their way to Vanders' stomach, where they'd hatched. Most of the lizards had died, but a large one had survived and was now eating Vanders' body from the inside out. The doctor announced that all he had to do was remove the lizard from Vanders' body, and the man would be cured. He then called for the nurse, who dutifully brought a large syringe filled with what Dr. Doherty claimed was a powerful medicine. In truth, the syringe was filled with a drug that induced vomiting. Dr. Doherty carefully inspected the syringe to make sure it was working right, and then ceremoniously injected his frightened patient with the fluid. In a grand gesture, he left the room, not saying another word to the stunned family. It wasn't long before the patient began to vomit. The nurse provided a basin, and Vanders heaved, wailed, and retched for a time. At a point that Dr. Doherty judged to be near the end of vomiting, he confidently strode back into the room. Nearing the bedside, he reached into his black doctor's bag and scooped up a green lizard, hiding it in his palm beyond anyone's notice. Then, just as Vanders vomited again, Dr. Doherty slipped the reptile into the basin. "Look, Vance," he immediately cried out with all the drama he could muster. "Look what has come out of you. You are now cured. The voodoo curse is lifted." The room was buzzing. Some family members fell to the floor moaning. Vanders himself jumped back away from the basin in a wide-eyed daze. Within a few minutes, he'd fallen into a deep sleep that lasted more than 12 hours. When Vanders finally awoke, he was very hungry and eagerly consumed so much food that the doctor feared his stomach would burst. Within a week, the patient had regained all his weight and strength. He left the hospital a well man and lived at least another 10 years. Is it possible that a man could just curl up and die simply because he thought he'd been hexed? Does the contemporary witch doctor, adorned with a stethoscope and holding a prescription pad, speak with the same conviction for us as the voodoo priest did for Vanders? And is our belief the same? And if it's indeed true that a person could, on one level, just decide to die, then could it also be true that a person with a terminal disease could make the decision to live? Can someone permanently change his or her internal state, dropping his or her identity as a cancer or arthritis victim or a heart patient or a person with Parkinson's, and simply walk into a healthy body just as easily as shedding one set of clothes and donning another? In the upcoming chapters, we'll explore what's really possible and how that applies to you. Chapter 2: A Brief History of the Placebo. As the saying goes, desperate times call for desperate measures. When Harvard-educated American surgeon Henry Beecher was serving in World War II, he ran out of morphine. Near the end of the war, morphine was in short supply in military field hospitals, so this situation wasn't uncommon. At the time, Beecher was about to operate on a badly wounded soldier. He was afraid that without a painkiller, the soldier might go into fatal cardiovascular shock. What happened next astounded him. Without skipping a beat, one of the nurses filled a syringe with saline and gave the soldier a shot, just as if she were injecting him with morphine. The soldier calmed down right away. He reacted as though he'd actually received the drug, even though all he'd received was a squirt of salt water. Beecher went ahead with the operation, cutting into the soldier's flesh, making what repairs were necessary, and sewing him back up, all without anesthesia. The soldier felt little pain and did not go into shock. How could it be, Beecher wondered, that salt water could stand in for morphine? After that stunning success, whenever the field hospital ran out of morphine, Beecher did the same thing again, injected saline, just as if he were injecting morphine. The experience convinced him of the power of placebos, and when he returned to the United States after the war, he began to study the phenomenon. In 1955, Beecher made history when he authored a clinical review of 15 studies published by the Journal of the American Medical Association that not only discussed the huge significance of placebos, but also called for a new model of medical research that would randomly assign subjects to receive active medications or placebos, what we now refer to as randomized, controlled trials, so that this powerful placebo effect wouldn't distort results. The idea that we can alter physical reality through thought, belief, and expectation alone, whether we are fully aware of what we're doing or not, certainly didn't start in that World War II field hospital. The Bible is filled with stories of miraculous healings, and even in modern times, people regularly flock to places such as Lourdes in southern France, where a 14-year-old peasant girl named Bernadette had a vision of the Virgin Mary in 1858, leaving behind their crutches, braces, and wheelchairs as proof that they'd been healed. Similar miracles have also been reported in Fatima, Portugal, where three shepherd children saw an apparition of the Virgin Mary in 1917. And in connection with a traveling statue of Mary carved for the 30th anniversary of the apparition, the statue was based on the description given by the oldest of the three children, who by then had become a nun, and it was blessed by Pope Pius XII before it was sent traveling around the world. Faith healing is certainly not confined to the Christian tradition. The late Indian guru Sathya Sai Baba, widely considered by his followers to be an avatar, a manifestation of a deity, was known to manifest holy ash called vibhuti from the palms of his hands. This fine grey ash has been said to have the power to heal many physical, mental, and spiritual ills when either eaten or applied to the skin as a paste. Tibetan lamas are also said to have healing powers, using their breath to heal by blowing on the sick. Even French and English kings reigning between the 4th and 9th centuries used the laying on of hands to cure their subjects. King Charles II of England was known to be particularly adept at this, performing the practice about 100,000 times. What is it that causes such so-called miraculous events? Whether the instrument of healing is faith in a deity alone, or belief in the extraordinary powers of a person, an object, or even a place deemed sacred or holy. What is the process by which faith and belief can bring about such profound effects? Might how we assign meaning to ritual, whether that ritual is saying the rosary, rubbing a pinch of holy ash onto our skin, or taking a new miracle drug prescribed by a trusted physician, play a role in the placebo phenomenon? What if the internal state of mind of the people who received these cures was influenced or altered by the conditions in their external environment, a person, place, or thing at the proper time, to such a degree that their new state of mind could actually affect real physical changes? In the 1770s, Viennese physician Franz Anton Mesmer made quite a name for himself by developing and demonstrating what was considered at that time a medical model of miraculous healing. Expanding on an idea of Sir Isaac Newton's about the effect of planetary gravitation on the human body, Mesmer came to believe that the body contained an invisible fluid that could be manipulated to heal people, using a force he called animal magnetism. His technique involved asking his patients to look deeply into his eyes before moving magnets over their bodies to direct and balance this magnetic fluid. Later, he found that he could wave his hands, without the magnets, to produce the same effect. Soon after each session began, his patients would start trembling and twitching before going into convulsions that Mesmer considered therapeutic. Mesmer would continue the fluid balancing until they were calm again. He used this technique to heal a variety of maladies, from serious conditions like paralysis and convulsive disorders, to more minor difficulties, such as menstrual problems and hemorrhoids. In what became his most famous case, Mesmer partially cured teenage concert pianist Maria Teresa von Parodi of hysterical blindness, a psychosomatic condition she'd had since about the age of 3. She stayed in Mesmer's home for weeks as he worked with her, and finally helped her to be able to perceive motion, and even distinguish color. But her parents were less than overjoyed by her progress, because they stood to lose a royal pension if their daughter was cured. In addition, as her sight returned, her piano playing deteriorated because she now was able to watch her fingers on the keyboard. Rumors, never substantiated, began circulating that Mesmer's relationship to the pianist was improper. Her parents forcibly removed her from Mesmer's house. Her blindness returned, and Mesmer's reputation diminished considerably. Armand Marie Jacques de Castanet, a French aristocrat known as the Marquis de Ségur, observed Mesmer and took his ideas to the next level. Ségur would induce a deep state that he called magnetic somnambulism, similar to sleepwalking, in which his subjects had access to deep thoughts and even intuitions about their health and that of others. In this state, they were extremely suggestible and would follow instructions, although they had no memory of what happened once they came out of it. Whereas Mesmer thought that the power was in the practitioner over the subject, Ségur believed that the power was in the thought of the subject, directed by the practitioner, over his or her own body. This was perhaps one of the first therapeutic attempts to explore the mind-body relationship. In the 1800s, Scottish surgeon James Braid took the idea of mesmerism still further, developing a concept he called neurohypnotism, what we now call hypnotism. Braid became intrigued by the idea when one day he arrived late for an appointment, only to find his waiting patient calmly staring in intense fascination at the flickering flame of an oil lamp. Braid found the patient to be in an extremely suggestible state, as long as his attention remained so locked, thereby fatiguing certain parts of his brain. After many experiments, Braid learned to get his subjects to concentrate on a single idea while staring at an object, which put them into a similar trance that he felt he could use to cure their disorders, including chronic rheumatoid arthritis, sensory impairment, and the various complications of spinal injuries and stroke. Braid's book, Neurohypnology, details many of his successes, including the story of how he cured both a 33-year-old woman, whose legs were paralyzed, and a 54-year-old woman with a skin disorder and severe headaches. Then esteemed French neurologist Jean-Martin Charcot weighed in on Braid's work, claiming that the ability to go into such a trance was possible only in those suffering from the condition of hysteria, which he considered an inherited neurological disorder that was irreversible. He used hypnosis not to cure patients, but to study their symptoms. Finally, a rival of Charcot's, a doctor named Hippolyte Bernheim at the University of Nancy, insisted that the suggestibility so central to hypnotism was not confined to hysterics, but was a natural condition for all humans. He implanted ideas in subjects, telling them that when they awoke from their trance, they would feel better and their symptoms would disappear. Thus he used the power of suggestion as a therapeutic tool. Bernheim's work continued into the early 1900s. Although each of these early explorers of suggestibility had a slightly different focus and technique, they were all able to help hundreds and hundreds of people heal a wide variety of physical and mental problems by changing their minds about their maladies and about how those illnesses were expressed in their bodies. During the first two world wars, military doctors, most notably Army psychiatrist Benjamin Simon, used the concept of hypnotic suggestibility, which I'll discuss further later, to help returning soldiers who suffered from the trauma that was first labeled shell shock, but is now known as post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. These veterans had suffered through such horrible war experiences that many of them numbed themselves to their emotions as a form of self-preservation, developed amnesia surrounding the horrific events, or worse, kept reliving their experiences in flashbacks, all of which can cause stress-induced physical illness. Simon and his colleagues found hypnosis extremely useful for helping the veterans face their traumas and cope with them so that they wouldn't have to resurface as anxiety and physical ailments, including nausea, high blood pressure, and other cardiovascular disorders, and even suppressed immunity. Like those practitioners in the century before them, Army doctors employing hypnosis helped their patients alter their pattern of thinking in order to get well and reclaim their mental and physical health. These hypnosis techniques were so successful that civilian doctors also became interested in using suggestibility, although many did so not by putting their patients into a trance, but by occasionally giving them sugar pills and other placebos and telling them that these drugs would make them better. The patients often did get better, responding to suggestibility in the same way that Beecher's wounded soldiers responded to the belief that they were receiving shots of morphine. This was, in fact, Beecher's era, and after he wrote his groundbreaking 1955 review calling for the use of randomized controlled trials with placebos for testing drugs, the placebo became a serious part of medical research. Beecher's point was well taken. Initially, researchers expected that a study's control group, the group taking the placebo, would remain neutral, so that comparisons between the control group and the group taking the active treatment would show how well the active treatment worked. But in so many studies, the control group was indeed getting better. Not just on their own, but because of their expectation and belief that they might be taking a drug or receiving a treatment that would help them. The placebo itself might have been inert, but its effect was certainly not. And these beliefs and expectations were proving to be extremely powerful. So somehow that effect had to be teased out from the data if that data was to have any real meaning. To that end, and heeding Beecher's petition, researchers began making the randomized, double-blind trial the norm, randomly assigning subjects to either the active or the placebo group, and making sure none of the subjects or any of the researchers themselves knew who was taking the real drug and who was taking the placebo. This way, the placebo effect would be equally active in each group, and any possibility that the researchers might treat subjects differently according to what group they were in would be eliminated. These days, studies are sometimes even triple blind, meaning not only are the participants and researchers who are conducting the trial in the dark about who's taking what until the end of the study, but the statisticians analyzing the data also don't know until their job is done. Of course, there's always a flip side. While suggestibility was garnering more attention because of its ability to heal, it also became apparent that the same phenomenon could be used to harm. Such practices as hexes and voodoo curses illustrated the negative side of suggestibility. In the 1940s, Harvard physiologist Walter Bradford Cannon, who had in 1932 coined the term fight or flight, studied the ultimate nocebo response, a phenomenon that he called voodoo death. Cannon examined a number of anecdotal reports of people with strong cultural beliefs in the power of witch doctors or voodoo priests suddenly falling ill and dying, despite no apparent injury or evidence of poison or infection, after ending up on the receiving end of a hex or curse. His research laid the groundwork for much of what we know today about how physiological response systems enable emotions, fear in particular, to create illness. The victim's belief in the power of the curse itself to kill him was only part of the psychological soup that brought about his ultimate demise, Cannon said. Another factor was the effect of being socially ostracized and rejected, even by the victim's own family. Such people quickly became the walking dead. Harmful effects from harmless sources aren't restricted to voodoo, of course. Scientists in the 1960s coined the term nocebo, Latin for I shall harm, as opposed to I shall please, the Latin translation of placebo, referring to an inert substance that causes a harmful effect, simply because someone believes or expects it will harm her. The nocebo effect commonly pops up in drug studies when subjects who are taking placebos either just expect that there will be side effects to the drug being tested, or when the subjects are specifically warned of potential side effects, and then they experience those same side effects by associating the thought of the drug with all of the potential causations, even though they've not taken the drug. For obvious ethical reasons, few studies are designed specifically to look at this phenomenon, although some do exist. A famous example is a 1962 study done in Japan with a group of children who were all extremely allergic to poison ivy. Researchers rubbed one forearm of each child with a poison ivy leaf, but told them that the leaf was harmless. As a control, they rubbed the child's other forearm with a harmless leaf that they claimed was poison ivy. All of the children developed a rash on the arm rubbed with the harmless leaf that was thought to be poison ivy. and 11 of the 13 children developed no rash at all where the poison ivy had actually touched them. This was an astounding finding. How could children who were highly allergic to poison ivy not get a rash when exposed to it?